Hello and welcome to the Home of Medicine podcast with me, Dr. Amy Burbridge. I'm a consultant in acute and general internal medicine in Coventry in the United Kingdom. And today I'm joined by...
Hi, I'm Ben Lovell. I'm also a consultant in acute and general medicine, and I live and work in London in the UK.
So I've got a case I just want to talk to you about. We've recently recorded a podcast about admitting or not admitting patients. And a couple of days after having that discussion on the podcast back in June of this year, I had a very similar situation, and I thought this would be a good follow-up case.
Okay.
So I was in the same day emergency care unit, and it was a Monday. And a gentleman came in to see me. He was 67 years old. He had no past medical history of note. He sat down in the chair. I've got this really nice clinic room now. Esteck has been done up. Very lovely. And he sat down and I said, how are you? And he was like, well, I've had this chest pain. I went to see my GP last Thursday and I've come back today and I went to see my GP today. And my general practitioner has referred me to come to hospital. He went to his GP on the Thursday with left-sided chest pain, radiating round the back, worse on movement. He's a lorry driver. He drives long distances all over the United Kingdom and was finding that the pain was worse on moving the steering wheel. The pain was partially relieved with paracetamol and anti-inflammatories. And actually, over the weekend, he was very fit and well. On the Monday, he went back to his GP because of the pain hadn't got any better and was in fact getting worse. He'd been at work all night that night. He tended to drive through the night and noticed that the pain again was worse on movement. His GP wrote a letter that said, please, this 67-year-old gentleman who presents with chest pain, please rule out a myocardial infarction. So I took a history and he was very fit and well. The chest pain he described was left-sided, radiating around the back. It was persistent, made worse on movement. There was no shortness of breath, no sweating, no nausea, no vomiting, no cough. There was no indigestion or dyspeptic-like symptoms associated with the pain. He'd never had pain like this before. He had no significant past medical history of note. He was a smoker and smoked 20 to 30 cigarettes per day. He didn't drink any alcohol. There was no illicit drug use, no family history of any cardiac-related problems. And he, socially, he lived with his wife and had stairs at home, was able to mobilise around the stairs over the weekend, and in fact was able to work over the weekend as well. And in fact, we had a really long conversation about his job, who he worked for, what he did, what his normal day-to-day, you know, job was like. He was really chatty and jolly and happy and looked very well. And I examined him and I felt his pulse. I listened to his heart. I listened to his lungs. He looked incredibly well. Examination was completely normal. And in fact, he even did star jumps in the clinic room. So he was trying to show to me how fit and healthy he was that he started doing star jumps. He was a real character. He was you know, he just really connects with some patients. And we had a really good consultation. I felt like I really understood what was going on and he just looked incredibly well. And I'm just going to stop there. And what are your thoughts?
Did you ask him to do star jumps or did he just spontaneously burst into them?
I didn't ask him to do star jumps. It's not something that I tend to do in my physical examination, but I said to him, you know, you're obviously incredibly healthy. And he was like, look what I can do. And was doing star jumps. And it was brilliant. You know, he had a real personality, a really strong character.
I think, okay, my surface reaction is you're describing a beautiful case of musculoskeletal chest pain. It happens whenever he turns a steering wheel. And he seems to be able to do some exertion without triggering the pain. I am profoundly unworried about cardiac disease from the history you've told me. I do respect when a colleague, a GP, professional colleague, refers someone in for my opinion about something. So I would, you know, do due diligence and I would make sure that I was absolutely certain his risk factors for cardiac disease. He sounds like a heavy smoker, and he's got a sedentary lifestyle. And it sounds like you've made it quite clear to yourself that when he says the pain comes on movement, it's with a specific turning of the wheel rather than exertion, which would obviously indicate angina. It doesn't sound pleuritic to me. I have, people who sit down a lot more likely to get DVTs. Could he have had a PE because he's a heavy smoker with a sedentary lifestyle? Doesn't sound like a PE to me because the pain seems to be coming and going rather than constant. And he does not have shortness of breath. So if I'd seen him in my SDEC, he would have had an ECG at the front door, which I'd be looking at in the assessment clinic. In all honesty, probably would have already had his bloods and his troponin done by the time I got round to seeing him, and I'd be seeing him with this data. But man, I would understand a clinician who discharged him at this point based on that history. I'm sensing there's going to be more to it, otherwise why are we discussing it? But in all honesty, I would be understanding if someone said, I took that history, I did that examination, I discharged him.
Yeah, and so he did have an ECG, which I reviewed, and the ECG was normal. I could see no abnormalities suggestive of myocardial infarction. He hadn't had any bloods done, and we had nobody doing bloods that day. So, and I ummed and ahed about taking blood from him. Not because I didn't want to, but because I was like, what's the value of these bloods? What is the chance of this gentleman having a myocardial infarction? So I was like, do you know what? I'll do some bloods. I'll just do some bloods. Something wasn't right, and I don't know what it was. I couldn't put my finger on it, but something felt icky. And I did some bloods. So I took him around to the bay. I did some bloods. Do you know how long it takes to label a blood bottle? So
Don't do
for
it in one
ages.
time.
Yeah. So I hadn't done it for ages, and I bled about 10 people this day. And it takes ages because you have to write really, really small. So anyway, I took some bloods from him. I checked his troponin. I was so confident that this man had not had an MI that I said, you can go home. I've checked your ECG. You've done star jumps in the clinic room. You look incredibly well. You've given me a strong history of musculoskeletal pain that is relieved with pain relief, that paracetamol and anti-inflammatories. My suggestion is don't go to work tonight because it's clearly exacerbating the pain. Take regular pain relief, paracetamol and anti-inflammatories. If the pain gets worse, go and see your GP or come back to us. I will contact you if your blood tests are abnormal. However, I strongly feel that these blood tests will be normal. Any thoughts?
I think that's completely reasonable. I think many clinicians wouldn't have progressed to blood tests, but we do this quite commonly in SDEC. We say, I'm doing bloods, I'll call you if there's a problem. The results take an hour, go home. I've got your number. No news is good news. Otherwise, we'll give you a call with any concerns. We do this quite a lot.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I did. I tend to do that. I like take the patient's number. I have a list of patients that I need to then contact. I'll say, I'll call you if there's a problem. If you don't hear from me, assume that all the blood tests are normal. However, this was a busy day and I sent the bloods off and more and more patients come and then you don't forget about them. You've got this pile growing. And at the back of my head was this gentleman, I must follow up these blood results. I must follow up these blood results. And guess what I didn't do?
You forgot.
I forgot. And I went home that evening. It was a Monday and I was about 6 p.m. and I'd finished my shift and I completely slipped my mind to follow up. And I don't know why it slipped my mind. It was busy. I was tired. I don't know. Many reasons, but I forgot. I went home the next morning. I came back in and I was like, I must check that man's bloods. And his troponin was 600.
Okay. And I'm guessing that your cutoff limit is well south of just 600 in your institution. That's a
So
very
our cutoff limit is less than three.
okay. Yeah.
Okay, so I felt sick.
Yeah.
I felt awful that, oh my God, this man has had this massive MI, obviously, and I've completely missed it. What have I done? So this set a chain of events off that morning. And I got his phone number and I phoned his mobile phone. There was no answer. And I kept phoning and phoning and phoning. There's no answer. So I was like, I need to phone his next of kin. So I couldn't get a next of kin number anywhere. I phoned the GP. I got the GP to give me the next of kin number. I phoned the next of kin and explained who I was, that I was the doctor from the hospital trying to get hold of her husband. And she was like, he's really poorly, he's at home. He's been up all night, he's sweating, he's got really bad chest pain. I'm really worried about him. And I was like, okay. So what I would suggest you do is go home and I will arrange an ambulance to come and pick your husband up. So I called 999 from the hospital and I was like, I've got a gentleman. I'm really worried that he's having a heart attack. Could you please pick him up from his home? And in the meantime, he called back on another line in the office and was like, one of the admin staff was like, Amy, I've got the gentleman on the phone you were trying to call. And I was like, oh, I was like, right, I've got an ambulance on one line. I've got the gentleman on the other line. I was like, hi, how are you? How are you feeling? And it was like, I feel awful. The pain's horrendous. I've been up all night. I can't get comfortable. And I was like, okay, not to worry. I'm going to get an ambulance on the way. I'm really worried now that we are dealing with a heart problem. And, you know, you need to come into hospital ASAP. And oh my God, just what was going through my head, you know, this was only a few weeks ago. The ambulance turned up. I stayed on the phone with him because I wanted to keep talking to him to make sure he was okay. The ambulance crew turned up and they were like, hi. So I'm the doctor. I saw him yesterday in clinic. How is he? And they were like, he looks really unwell. He's very sweaty. We're going to do a 12-lead ECG. They did a 12-lead ECG. And they went, this man's having an ST elevation myocardial infarction. And we've called a STEMI alert and he's coming to resus. And within an hour, he was in resus in our hospital. And he went to the cath lab and had primary PCI that day. Mm. You know, I can't even, I don't even know what to say. Is it my stupidity? You know, what did I miss the day before? Was I ignoring signs because I needed to get through patients? Was he downplaying his pain by doing the, you know, the star jumps in the clinic room? I don't know.
It sounds, I mean, he had a STEMI. And
he had a STEMI.
In retrospect, we think, oh, he had a STEMI and now maybe we know that. Was he having crescendo angina, unstable angina leading up to a STEMI? That's the new slant on it with our retrospectoscope, right? And one thing you're worrying about was, were you guilty of a bias or a thinking error, cognitive error called premature closure, which is when you decide on the diagnosis and once you've done that, you stop thinking and that is the diagnosis and that's what it is now. I have chosen it and you don't keep looking. As you heard from me, as you're presenting the story, I may not have even have taken bloods in the first place and you did. So I don't think you did experience premature closure because you still kept your net cast relatively wide and you looked for alternate diagnosis, which you did find. In the mix there's this whole thing of we got busy and I didn't check it. And maybe if I checked the troponin of 600 the night before, I could have pulled him in and we could have done the PCI prior to him having the STEMI or I don't know. So many ifs and things that you never know. Every clinician has patients like this in their internal library where you think I could have or should have done better. But even when you go back and people are listening to this, listening now will be thinking the same thing. What would you have done differently? This is how I work through these cases with the people I supervise. Going back now, what would you have done differently? And I suppose the superficial answer is I would have admitted him. I would have taken the history, done the trop-op, run the trop, kept him in and admitted him. But would you really, based on that history, would you really have admitted him based on that? I can't think of anyone who would unless they were the most risk-averse people in the world. Someone who did star jumps in their clinic room, someone who only had it when they did a certain motion. I think that if they did do it, they'd be getting very different feedback in way over 99% of the time, which is, look, you don't need to admit all of these patients who are coming in with any kind of pain between their nose and their knee. You need to be a bit more risk averse. It's only with the benefit of hindsight that we're picking up on these things. So I don't think hearing it secondhand that you experienced a cognitive error, that you had an error of thinking here or in clinical reasoning, which is what we talk about. I think a patient presented with a fascinatingly atypical presentation of a serious disease who had all the right tests done, but they're for the grace of God go I with someone that I saw in my clinic and sent home. And I have sent people home before who've gone home and something catastrophic has happened and they've come back in a real emergency. And I've thought to myself, I've ruminated going, how should I have picked this up beforehand? But there was no way of knowing. For example, a long time ago, I sent someone home who had a bit of vomit, a bit of diarrhea and vomiting after eating something dodgy, a bit of food poisoning. That was my diagnosis. First lactate was 2.5, a bit high, but she'd been vomiting. She was dry. Second lactate, beautifully, 1.5 came down, went home. And she went home and came back and she perfed. And she ended up having a laparotomy. And then, my goodness, the soul searching I did afterwards, going, how on earth can you confuse abdominal viscous perforation with diarrhea and vomiting? Do I even merit the degree that I hold, a title of doctor? But when something walk, something looks like a horse, sounds like a horse, it is a horse. And we say, don't always think zebras, but zebras come up. And I'm interested in thinking, A, how do we as clinicians process the zebras when we meet the zebras, when we feel that because they were a zebra, they came to harm that could have been presented? And second of all, how do we process things happening because we were human beings and we were working within the constraints and the demands of a particular environment? If you are so busy you can't even get to the toilet or have a drink of water or a lunch break, then of course you are not going to get around to checking blood tests, which you mentally deprioritized over more visible and urgent and present clinical scenarios, which are in front of your face. And 99 times out of 100, that won't come to any harm. But then if a zebra meets a human being who's working in an environment which demands them to be superhuman, which we can't, you will get a case like this. And I'm very interested in how we process this, we debrief this, and what's available to us to do so we can turn it into learning and not into a wound, which means that we either become completely risk averse moving forward, we become disturbed, depressed, anxious about it. And we don't have something called previous case bias, which means every single person we meet gets the full head-to-toe treatment because we once got burnt on a case like this. How do we negotiate these so we move forward? Did you say this only happened a few weeks ago?
It's
Tell me
very fresh.
tell me what your process is, because I think this is useful to share with anyone listening who we all have cases like this. How did you move forward?
So I'm still in that process now, actually. I'm still moving through it. So to finish the case, what happened with him is he came in on the Tuesday. He went straight to the cath lab where he had a very successful PCI. And I thought, I'm going to have to do duty of candor. I'm going to have to tell him that I messed up because I did. And that's, I genuinely believe that I made a mistake. And I need to own that mistake. Regardless of what went on during the day or how busy it was, I do think that I could have done things differently. I felt there was something icky with the case, which is why I did the blood tests. So the question is, if I did a troponin, I should have waited for the result of that before sending him home. He was very keen to go home. He looked very well. So I was biased by that as well. So he had his PCI. I went to see him the day of his PCI later on in the Tuesday evening. He was sitting up in bed reading a paper. He looked incredibly well. And he was like really happy to see me. He was like, oh, thank you so much for phoning me. If he hadn't have phoned me at home, he hadn't have called an ambulance, I wouldn't have come in. Thank you so. And he was thanking me, and I was like, "You shouldn't be thanking me. I was the one who missed this yesterday." And I apologized and said, "I'm sorry. I should have kept you in yesterday." And he was like, "No, I was fine. I wanted to go home. He did the right thing." I was like, "Okay, we'll let that lie." So I said, "I'm sorry. I did a blood test. I should have called you. I didn't call you. I called you in the morning." And he said, "But you didn't call me, so that's okay." And I was like, okay, he was had no issues at all, the patient. He was absolutely lovely. What was really interesting was the notes from the admitting team who'd seen him. This patient was seen yesterday by a consultant in acute medicine in the resuscitation area of ED. I didn't see him in resus. The gentleman was seen and discharged with a troponin of 600.
Unacceptable.
This was clearly missed myocardial infarction. So number one, I didn't see him in resus. Number two, I didn't have his troponin result. And number three, I hadn't. And it was just really interesting. This was documented in the notes. It was in black and white. So I then documented my duty of candor and I explained the situation. I detailed it clearly. What had happened, I said, this man was not seen in resuscitation area yesterday. He was seen in the same dementia care. But also, if I had seen him in resus with the same presenting complaint, would I have sent him home? Probably not, because where we see people also biases our decision-making. I saw him in a beautiful clinic room, did a lovely consultation with him, instead of in a busy resus where everybody's sick. So if I'd seen him in an area where I expect to see sick people, I would have probably kept him in. Because I saw him in an area where I expect to see well people, I sent him home. And it just got me thinking about, does the location we see people affect our decisions?
And to add to that, a patient sitting in a waiting room in their own clothes versus a patient lying down in a hospital gown in a bed look like two separate patients. Everyone looks so much better when they're dressed and sitting up, when they're pyjamaed and lying down.
Yeah, it's completely different. He was in his own clothes. He was sitting, chatting, you know, so well. And then obviously when you see him in resus in a hospital gown,
yeah,
it's very different. And it just made me really reflect on that. But that at the day when this happened, I chatted to colleagues at work and said, this is what I've done. I cannot believe I've messed up. And there were a few who were like, you should have kept him in. You did the blood test, you should have kept him in. And there were a few who were like, you didn't do anything wrong. You safety netted him. You know, you just forgot to phone him. And it was different opinions on how I dealt with it. So I think going to speak to him and explaining what had happened was the right thing to do. You know, we do have a duty of candor that we have to tell patients when we do something that could have adversely affected their outcome. So having a conversation with him sort of did help. Has it affected how many troponins I do, how many blood tests I do? Potentially, yes. I'm not entirely sure, because as I say, I'm still sort of in the middle of it all and I'm still working through it in my head. He's safe. He's well. He had the right treatment. Actually, an adverse event, I guess, didn't happen to him. To be honest, but I still should have admitted him. To admit or not to admit, that is the question. And I still don't know the answer.
I wouldn't have admitted him. I think that if we were going to work through this, if I was, for example, if you were my trainee and we're working together, I think the way I would frame it is I would say, well done on picking up that something was not quite right and doing the tests. Well done for actually doing the blood test, because you felt that was clinically indicated. Well done on picking up and getting that patient back in and getting in the treatment we need. In terms of moving forward, why don't we make a plan now that you're going to do differently moving forward to come out of this? And this is just one learning point, because this is a training and this is what we do. We learn every day. So why don't we say the one thing you do differently next time is, if you do decide to do a troponin on a patient, maybe they're the one patient which you always wait for the result for, that you wait that 1 hour for. LFTs, bone profile, you know, anything else, send them home. We'll give them a call. Because then if we do not get around to calling them, it may be the end of the world. But maybe troponins for movement, that's the one thing you do differently. I think it's really important when you're debriefing cases like this, you come out with one single objective thing you do differently next time, rather than, I'm terrible, I would just do everything differently next time. And that's, I think that's more of a useful learning point, and it helps people sort of draw a line under things a bit better. So that's probably how I would work through it with you if you were my trainee. I don't think you would forget or not get around to doing blood tests, as reviewing the blood test results again in a shift now because of what's happened to you.
No, absolutely not. No.
So I don't think that would be such a useful action point to come out of it. But I would have that conversation with you, and then I'd consider the matter closed. I think it's amazing how understanding patients are when you are open.
Oh. Yeah.
And that happened to me before. You think, I'm going to get in so much trouble. But actually, they can be completely understanding when you explain. I remember cases I read in the media about families saying, we forgive the doctor who made this error that it caused my relative's death, because I understand they were under huge amounts of stress. There was a casework, and I was training of a trainee doctor who accidentally misprescribed, misadministered insulin, and the patient died from an insulin overdose. And in the inquest, it came out that that doctor had been done 100 hours that week, was covering too many wards, was carrying too many bleeps. They'd simply burnt out at the end of that shift, and they, as a human being, would. And their family said, we place no blame with Dr. X, because we understand they were operating under different conditions, and we urge the hospital to rethink the environment doctors work in. If this has happened to my relative and they've lost their life, I think people can be profoundly understanding sometimes. And as the duty of candor says, we have to be absolutely open and honest with all patients who are involved in a mistake or a near miss, which I think was absolutely right that you did it and documented it. My final thought is just to everyone, be careful what you write down in a medical legal document. It is not the
Oh, I know.
place to air grievances. It's not a place
No,
to
I
protest
know.
yours. And I see quite frequently, patient was failed discharge from the medical team yesterday. It's like, hang on a minute, it was a reasonable discharge. Or patient was sent home yesterday, unclear why to me, as obviously very sick. You know, stuff like that. Just be careful, because when that is read out in black and white, it sounds like accusations, which then you are going to have to explain why you made that accusation. So keep it factual is my advice.
Yeah, and I think as an acute medic who, I mean, I see so the number of patients I see on a day-to-day basis, we see large numbers of patients. We make many, many decisions and we balance uncertainty all day, every day. You know, that to admit or not to admit, to do bloods or not to do bloods, to thrombolize or not to thrombolize. We make massive decisions. And these decisions range from to do a blood test or not, or to the more extreme, to cardiovert or not to cardiovert. To thrombolize or not to thrombolize, we are very much making decisions on very, very well patients to very, very sick patients in the course of a day. Our spectrum of patients we see is massive, huge. And it really made me reflect on the number of patients we see, the amount of time we are given to see each patient, how we are biased by the place we see them, resus, A&E, estet clinic, trolley, waiting room. You know, that does massively change how we see patients. And he told me a story I wanted to hear because he wanted to go home. But also, I took the story that I wanted to hear because I wanted him to go home because that was what he wanted. And, you know, I'm always banging on about listen to your patient, they are telling you the diagnosis. And I probably didn't do that on that day. Or maybe I did because I did the blood test, but I was just ignoring that little sign inside of me that was saying, don't discharge, don't discharge. And I sent him home anyway. Oh, I was really, what really upset me was the comment in the notes. I don't know why this patient was sent home. Clearly missed MI. And I'm like, well, I didn't, it wasn't clearly an MI. I wouldn't have sent this man home if he'd had a myocardial infarction. And it was quite accusatory and absolute, you know, it makes me think how we speak to people at work, how we communicate, how we document. You know, it's all about being kind and civil to the people we work with. And that one line really upset me, probably more than.
I can see. I can tell. I think we have to work from the basic assumption. I do a lot of simulation training, and we have something called the basic assumption. And the basic assumption is everybody is trained and intelligent and wants to do a good job. You have to start from there. It is very rare, fascinatingly rare, that anyone in healthcare comes into work and says, I'm going to do a really bad job today. I'm going to harm patients and hurt people's feelings. I mean, that is, it's in the news like once in a blue moon. It does happen, but it's rare. We have to come from the basic assumption that people, I thought they were doing the right thing at the time, and work from that point, rather than people are just negligent and lazy.
I really like that idea actually, that we all go to work wanting to do the best we could possibly do. And I didn't in this case, and that was not intentional. I didn't intentionally not do the best I could do. It was just human error.
And I think just be so careful with what you write. I'm not even a fan of exclamation points in notes, medical
Oh.
notes. I my notes are very dry. I just think, how would it be if a patient saw these notes as one thing? How would it be if I had to read these notes out at some kind of formal events, which is not unusual that in your career you get invited to an inquest or a coroner's meeting. And would I be able to back this up with actual evidence, or am I right? I've seen people write essays and notes about another staff member hurt their feelings and why it's unprofessional, and it doesn't belong there. By all means, address this via the appropriate routes, but the notes are medical legal records, and I think they should be kept as they are, as legal documents.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, another interesting to admit or not to admit. And I think these are the cases that we deal with day to day in acute medicine. You know, should I admit this patient or should I not? And we deal with that uncertainty. And I still don't know how to manage uncertainty best. Some days I think I do it well, some days I don't do it as well. And that's probably a fraction of how I'm feeling internally, to be
As you
honest.
say, you and I, we have chosen a specialty which mandates that we see thousands of patients a year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
If that's 10 decisions per patient, I can't even do the maths. So we have chosen a specialty which mandates that we see many, many, many patients. Are we seriously going to say, I'm going to see thousands of patients a year and not make one error? That's in human factors, that's called the perfection myth, because it is a myth that you can concentrate really hard and think and be really clever and do lots of reading and be completely mindful and you never make a mistake. And we know from studying human beings and going about their business, it is an absolute myth. So you have to build organizations and structures which catch our mistakes and try and minimize the harm when it comes to them. And you did catch your mistake and you did bring the patient in rather than let him stay at home and continue to infarct. And make sure we don't have punishments in place for people who did not achieve perfection, because we know it is a myth.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at the end of the day, the patient had a good outcome. He went home the day after his procedure and he was really happy and he saw no concern with any of the care that he received.
That's nice.
So, yeah, so that was a good outcome to maybe a not so good clinical decision that I made. And I'll reflect on that and learn from that. And I will talk about that. So talking about it on the podcast and also talk about it in peer learning at work and, you know, share suggestions and, you know, what would we do differently next time? Another interesting case. Thank you so much, Ben, again, for your wonderful words of wisdom. It's almost like I've had like a therapy session had some of these. So I hope everybody also got some learning points from that case. Thank you to everybody out there for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Home of Medicine podcast, a podcast brought to you by the EFIM Academy in association with the European Federation of Internal Medicine, a leading organisation in internal medicine. Thanks for listening.